Welcome to the Cloud Pod, where the forecast is always cloudy. We talk weekly about all things AWS, GCP, and Azure. We are your hosts,
Justin,
Jonathan,
Ryan,
and Matthew.
Episode 299, recorded for April 1st, 2025. We predict next for next week's Next Level Google Next event. What's next? Good evening, Ryan and Matt. I am impressed that I made it through that on the first try.
That is impressive.
I am impressed. Yeah.
Yeah. Like when I wrote it down, I was like, this is going to be a problem. But I did it. I feel pretty confident. And I even did it on April Fool's Day. So yeah. It worked out really well both ways. So, yeah. There you go. Yes, it is Google Next week before, though. And so hopefully you guys have all done your homework, which I know neither of you have.
Which is tradition
of the Google Next prediction show and even the Amazon one. And then
Amazon, I think we're a little bit better on.
It's a little easier to kind of see what they're doing. I'd love to be able to do one for Azure, because I think you've called out before, like, hey, why don't we do an Azure one? And it's because I don't even know what conference Microsoft actually announces anything.
Is it Ignite?
Is it Build?
Is it Build?
I don't know. It's the hard part.
It's the November one.
Which is what?
I don't know what it's called. Don't ask me hard questions after work. Like, it's after work. Easier questions here, guys. I think the other problem is we're also all gearing up for the AWS conference. It would be like November 1st. We would have to do one. And then like 2 weeks later, we have to do reInvent before Thanksgiving, which is always a problem.
Oh my God, that's such a terrible thing. So the Microsoft Ignite last year took place November 18th to 22nd, 2024 in Chicago, right? So you literally have Ignite, then Thanksgiving, and then reInvent.
Yeah.
That is just bad timing. Why did they do it so close? That's so silly. Hey, thank you, Google, for putting your conference in April. I do really appreciate that.
Week after Thanksgiving was never fun in Vegas?
No, it was terrible. It's sometimes very cold.
Always.
You know, you have to travel with all the people trying to escape from their terrible Thanksgiving vacations to get there, which is sort of depressing. And then, you know, you're leaving your family after, you know, right before the middle of holiday shopping season. It's terrible. It's a terrible time. I've enjoyed watching it from home now multiple years in a row.
I have too.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we have some news to get to. We'll catch up on the Google Next predictions in the Google section. First up, let's get to AI. It's how machine learning makes money. Our favorite section of the week. OpenAI is apparently embracing Anthropic's standard for connecting AI assistants to the systems where the data resides. By adopting Anthropic's Model Context Protocol, or MCP, across its products, including the desktop app for ChatGPT. MCP is an open source standard that helps AI models produce better, more relevant responses to certain queries. Sam Altman says that people love MCP and they are excited to add support across their products, and that is available today in Agents SDK, and support for the ChatGPT desktop and response API is coming very soon. And then I said to myself, well, I don't actually know what MCP means or why you guys, and so I assume you don't know what it is either. So I went and found two blog posts. The most helpful of the two was from Adi Osmani, who wrote a great blog post going into a very complex detail. So she starts out with an explaining like M5, which I always appreciate because sometimes I need to be babied through these things. And then she gets into way more technical depth. So I'm going to blindly quote verbatim from her blog. So thank you, Addy. Imagine you have a single universal plug that fits all your devices. That's essentially what the Model Context Protocol, or MCP, is for AI. MCP is an open standard, think USB-C for AI integrations, that allows AI models to connect to many different apps and data sources in a consistent way. In simple terms, MCP lets an AI assistant talk to various software tools using a common language instead of each tool requiring a different adapter or custom code. So what does this mean in practice? If you're using an AI coding assistant like Cursor or Windsurf, MCP is the shared protocol that lets the assistant use external tools on your behalf. For example, with MCP, an AI model could fetch information from a database, edit a design in Figma, or control a music app, all by sending natural language instructions through a standardized interface. You or the AI no longer need to manually switch contexts or learn about each tool's API. The MCP translator bridges the gap between human language and software commands. So basically, in a nutshell, MCP is like giving your AI assistant a universal remote control to operate all your digital devices and services. Instead of being stuck in its own world, your AI can now reach out and press the buttons of other applications safely and intelligently. And this common protocol means one AI can integrate with thousands of tools as long as those tools have an MCP interface, eliminating the need for custom integrations for each new app. And the result, your AI helper becomes far more capable, able to not just chat about things, but take actions in the software you use. I consider this to be a SQL for AI.
I would just say focus for AI, but maybe that's because I was dealing with bills all day today.
That could be.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't read Addy's blog. I should. I read the Google announcement, which is sort of had some code examples and stuff that sort of solidified it for me. But I think I wish I would have read the received the explain it to me like I'm five. So I think I would have understood it better. Because that's the one thing I don't understand is like, yeah, I like the idea. Everything that's said in here is great, but you know, it feels still like you have to configure an integration. It's just a standardized language for those integrations. But there's still that exchange of information that has to happen somewhere. But you know, I do think we need AI to do more things versus just talking about them. So I think it's great.
I mean, I assume there's going to be a lot of these kind of standardizations. So it's interesting that, you know, Anthropic's became the popular one. I don't exactly know why that's the case. I think maybe it's in Addy's blog. I didn't quite get all the way through her blog because it's lengthy and very detailed and very not, like, I feel much more intelligent because of reading it. Mm-hmm. So again, thank you to her. I am curious, like, what made MCP better than anyone else's work on this area?
Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if it's also like first to market to like put the standard out there, or
that's
there's other standards that we don't know about.
I mean, I wrote no SQL.
Please don't do SQL for AI.
Well, yeah, I'm trying to figure out how that would even work. Like, is your natural language
SQL
prompt?
I have no idea how it would work, but I mean, like, we made it work for NoSQL. We added SQL to NoSQL. Why can't we add it to AI?
Select star from AI. Yeah. Where?
Yeah, maybe you just have to speak out your SQL query.
There you go. Yeah.
Select you inner join to multiple AIs? So you can query multiple at once.
It's like when the home assistants came out and you had your Google and your Alexa, and you just put them at each other.
Yeah. They both just talk all day.
Unfortunately, yeah. you couldn't have them, you know, like use the same activate code. So you could say one time and then get all three to respond to you. That would have been cool.
Yeah.
Did multiple not do, was it only AWS that did computer? I remember that one was on there. I don't think anybody ever did that, but yeah, I know you could change the default for Alexa's at the V8. I thought one of the other ones did it too, but maybe ML.
Not sure. All right, well, Databricks is announcing support for Anthropic Claude 3.7 Sonnet, late to the party, but you know, it's available in all of your Databricks capabilities, including natively available in Databricks across AWS, Azure, and GCP. And for the first time, you can securely access Claude's advanced reasoning, planning, and agentic capabilities directly from within Databricks. Surprising. They were first, you know, right on top of Llama and all that. Owner of Anthropic didn't give them a heads up. They were like, screw you, Databricks.
Yeah, I wonder. Or if it, yeah. I'm not really sure. I, you know, it's also without, I don't know what it takes to sort of operate a model garden, you know, now I think about it. Because, you know, in my head, it should be relatively simple. Just like you download a model from like Hugging Face and plug it in and just change your UI.
Sure.
Probably not, though.
Yeah. Just because they call it a garden doesn't make it easy.
Just plant a new one. It grows. It'll be fine. Theirs took a little bit longer to grow. Don't judge. It was missing the sun.
Yeah. OpenAI is in trouble this week a little bit because their new ChatGPT image capability, which we sort of made fun of last week, maybe a little bit prematurely, because I think in hindsight, I didn't have access to the new model yet.
Uh-oh.
But, you know, I did try again and it still failed miserably. So even with the new model, which I now know I have, I think I'm okay. still going to stand for last week's episode. But apparently they're making realistic versions of Studio Ghibli's unique cartoon anime style, which will probably get them sued over copyright infringement. I love that the article, the information that they created a Studio Ghibli using the AI of Studio Ghibli's lawyers chasing Sam Altman, which is fantastic.
That really is truly fantastic.
Yeah, that's a little bit of fun. Impress someone deserves a bonus for that.
Yeah,
that was a good play. So if your AI rips off a very famous artistic style that only one studio in the world uses and does, and is also beloved by fans of Studio Ghibli, who talk about all the time about, you know, how much time it takes them to write each frame or draw each frame, paint each frame of their cartoons, is a very passion project for the creators of Studio Ghibli Work to have an AI just come in and just ruthlessly copy it. I can definitely see why that one got some attention from people.
Read the room.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, it's a little sensitive already with AI scraping data and, you know, reusing people's copyrighted work. Like, oof.
Yep.
They feel like there was a sales opportunity they missed here. Here, we've built this tool for you guys. Would you like it? It will automate your entire process.
I mean, I you know, typically seeing the reaction to most artists whose work has been ripped off by AI, I don't think that'd be their reaction.
Nope.
Well, no, I said before they launched it, not after. But
even then, yeah. I think, you know, like from what I've seen, you know, people, you know, and their commentary about it, I don't think
that's the fire. I think they would get a very harsh response. And, you know, it's sad because I think it's a, you know, within OpenAI, I think this is a passion project, right, that someone did because they like the artwork so much. And they, you know, and so, but it's also like you have to be aware of the larger picture for AI.
All right, let's move on to Amazon news this week. They are giving us kind of the bottom of the barrel, I think, news this week. Even Azure was a little bit quiet this week. I think everyone's kind of preparing for whatever is going to come out of Google next week. But first up, firewall support for AWS Amplify host sites. You can now integrate the AWS WAF with your AWS Amplify hosting. Web application owners are constantly working to protect their applications from a variety of threats. Previously, if you wanted to implement a robust security posture for your Amplify-hosted application, you need to create architectures using Amazon CloudFront distributions with AWS WAF protection enabled, which require additional configuration steps, expertise, and management overhead. With the general availability of AWS WAF for Amplify hosting, you can now directly attach a web app firewall to your AWS Amplify apps through a one-click integration in the Amplify console using infrastructure as code. This integration gives you access to a full range of AWS WAF capabilities, including managed rules, which provides protection against common web exploits, and vulnerabilities like SQL injection and cross-site scripting. You can also create your own custom rules based on your specific application needs.
Yeah, this is one of those the rough edges that you find the wrong way. So I'm glad they fixed this. Like, you know, if you're using Amplify, I'm sure you don't want to get, you know, down in the dirty in network routing and how to implement the WAF. And so you're looking for something to apply the managed rules and protect yourself from bots and that kind of traffic. So this is, I imagine this is a great integration for those people that are using Amplify.
I don't know who those people are, but I'd like to meet them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I assume it's just the ex-Beanstalk users.
I mean, definitely is a nice thing, but also, like, I don't see that adding CloudFront and a WAF at CloudFront, if you are at that scale where you're trying to protect yourself, is that big of a lift. I don't know enough about Amplify and how you kind of...
Well, I mean, one of the things about Amplify is you use it to build static web apps, like, you know, and then you typically use S3 for the hosting of the site, which then requires, you know, something like CloudFront if you want to do caching. CloudFront, so
either way.
It was a little confusing to me too. Like, but I do know that it also does something with mobile apps and does some other things where I think you do more advanced. I need to probably spend some quality time with Amplify again and maybe some AI assistance. To go play with it again, because I remember when I first came out, I played with it with Drekkle apps, and it was kind of cool, but I lost interest pretty quickly because, you know, doing a podcast website with Drekkle is a nightmare. So we just use WordPress, keep it simple.
Yeah.
Mostly because the RSS spec for podcasts is actually quite complicated, and has a bunch of extra fields that you must have for Apple to properly index your thing, and a plugin does it for basically free. Although we use Castos hosting now for our podcast, so. I'm not paying for it, but at the time it was free when we had no monies, which we still have no monies. Sure. So I guess we're just paying it out of pocket now, but it's all right. Please sponsor the podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
Please, pretty please. Otherwise, we're going to have to use Amplify.
I don't know if you have to be at scale to use, you know, CloudFront and WAF protections, because I think, you know, if you are hosting static content, you want it cached and you want it that, you know, you still want that local, even if it's little traffic.
Even if you don't want it, I always feel like, you know, as soon as you're hitting static, you're running it from S3 or somewhere else. You know, I don't know where else you would write it from.
Not the second time.
Right. It's like at that point, like, I feel like you're already putting a bucket in front, you know, a blob sort, or sorry, I can CDN in front of it. So at that point, you just enable it there. That's why I'm like, it's a really nice feature for people that aren't going to do that extra step. And it's in the console, press the button, it's done, you have it. And don't get me wrong, you know, that probably is more the target users than us. But I also feel like it's not a heavy lift to add that one piece in front of it, except for if Amplify doesn't natively support it.
Maybe. I just don't know. But yeah. I'll do some homework. Yeah, probably not until after next, but it's like a lot coming
up. I mean, while we were on, I did just say, what is Amplify into Gemini? Because I had it open because I wanted to make sure I was speaking about the right service.
The right one. But again, when last time I used it, it was for, really simple static apps, which, is not an unknown type of website that has to exist. It's just not something I needed. So I didn't pursue it further, but it'd be interesting to see what else it does now. I know they added mobile app support to it where you could do mobile things, and maybe it's much more powerful than I'm giving it credit for, which would be probably fair.
Yeah.
So. I mean, I feel like that's almost our downfall, as we always play with the stuff right when it first comes out, which is so MVP, which means by the time they add the features that make it anything usable, we've already discounted it. Because we're a little bit cynical here.
And we're not the target audience, right? Because I really do think the target audience is for people that don't know the back ends of cloud infrastructure and stuff. And so, annoyingly, that's the fun part for us, because we're not loved enough as a child or something. But I think it's not as daunting to us to set up something like that. Whereas I think if you're, largely doing sort of front end stuff, you've never really touched a back end, and you just want your new shiny web page out. I think that's
nothing about this marketing page I'm on right now makes me feel warm and fuzzy at all. Go from idea to app in hours, deploy server-side rendered and static front-end apps, and then deploy web frameworks globally, and go from front-end to full stack fast with TypeScript. I'm like, oh.
Yeah. I mean,
losing interest very quickly is what I'm noticing.
It's just not,
we're not the target audience.
We're not, it's the same reason why we'll always poo-poo Beanstalk. AWS Amplify is a very similar type product, which is you want an easy button for hosting. Okay. And this is a easy button for your CI/CD pipeline and hosting.
Fair. Let's move on to jumbo packets, because Amazon EC2 is now supporting more bandwidth and jumbo frames to select destinations.
That's been a while.
Yeah, Amazon EC2 now supports up to full EC2 instance bandwidth for inter-region VPC peering traffic and to AWS Direct Connect. Additionally, EC2 supports jumbo frames up to 8,500 bytes for cross-region VPC peering. Before today, the egress bandwidth for EC2 instances was limited to 50% of the aggregate bandwidth limit for the instance with 32 or more vCPUs and 5 gigabits or more for minor instances. Cross-region peering support up to 1,500 bytes, and now customers can send bandwidth from EC2 region or towards AWS Direct Connect at the full instance baseline specification, or 5 gigabytes per second, whichever is greater. Customers can use jumbo frames across regions for peered VPCs. So I can see some benefits, as much as I made fun of it. Mm-hmm. But it's sort of one of those things that you always run into in weird outage scenarios where your frames are too small and you're like, oh, we're doing too many packet retries and all these things. So it's nice, especially for going between between availability zones and cross-region peering, to be able to do that for things like SAN replication if you're using NetApps. Or other big, large replication things you might need to do with big payloads.
I wonder what the thing is on the back end that finally enabled them to enable this. What was the last thing that they were like, no, we can't enable it until we do this? And what was that thing at this point?
They fired their Ryan.
Okay, that's fine. All right.
The guy that said, no, we can't do that. Yeah, that's probably true. I imagine it's at the hardware level, like the last, when they announced Nitro and that whole management, they came out after that with a whole bunch of network level improvements.
Well, if you guys were to be paying attention this early for reInvent, I would maybe note this down somewhere that they did a very large VPC peering thing, which could be the sign of a new Nitro version coming that they'll talk about at their event later in November.
See, I don't even know where to put that note that I'll find it in 6 months.
That's why I have Google Docs. It's like my brain. Like things that I want to remember for the podcast, or like my predictions are on a different Google note that I didn't share with you guys. So you didn't steal them, you dirty punks.
We definitely
don't think we're smart enough to even think to go find yours. And
yeah. See, this is what I do all year long. I have a document called my prediction sheet, and I just slowly put things in throughout the year that I remember. So I've just now noted that, hey, they introduced jumbo packets, and that could be a new Nitro card. So I have it noted for myself. If you guys were that organized, you'd be better at this.
I'm visualizing just thousands and thousands of post-it notes for some reason.
It's sort of like that. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, 100%. All right. AWS Lambda is adding support for Ruby 3.4. Ruby's not dead, folks.
Oh.
AWS Lambda now supports creating serverless apps using Ruby 3.4, which I would not use Ruby for this, just like, to be fair. I'm not that much of a sadist. Ruby 3.4 was released in February 2025. It is the latest long-term support version of Ruby, which will be supported all the way until March 2028. This is both a managed runtime and a container-based image capability for you in serverless, and AWS will automatically apply updates to the managed runtime and base images as they become available, making your Ruby 3.4 world much easier to manage and support.
I am astonished because I did not think that Ruby was still a currently supported thing at all. And so I'm, you know, like after Ruby on Rails sort of started to be less popular after Chef development, I sort of just stopped using this altogether. So it's like,
But how many people probably still have all their old Ruby apps that are still running and they want to use the newest version?
I'm sure
there's a lot of legacy companies out there.
Yeah.
I mean, Ruby 8.02 just got shipped in March. Ruby on Rails 8.02 was March 12th released. So, like, it's definitely getting
there.
Released.
Must be still like a,
yeah, it's pretty heavy. It's DHH and it's Basecamp.
That's true.
Yeah.
And they also say, hey, and GitHub, Shopify, Instacart, Gusto. Okay.
Got it.
There's a whole list of kinds.
Now this makes sense. Now this makes more sense to me. Okay.
Coinbase apparently still uses Ruby on Rails. Square still uses it.
Allegedly. Yeah, there's one app somewhere in the back end that has it, and it's where they claim.
It's been years though since I've had to support Ruby's on Rails app.
It really has been a long time.
Which I try not to touch because it's not to fix. Mostly because I've mostly forgotten most of my Rails skills, and I'm like, I think, although AI might help me now.
I mean, it was always the gems that killed me. I was like, I'm not fighting through this dependency hell.
No. It was always rake for me personally. Uh-huh. Like, oh yeah, rake. I need to rake my database. Great. Let me figure out how to do that.
You had to like, what was it? Ruby environment to like switch between the Ruby versions
Ruby
and the gems.
Yeah. Ruby
and like go down the dependency. Oh, you pinned it. Oh, this one updated.
Well, so Ruby is why I got into containers, to be honest with you, because Ruby end was such a nightmare. I was like, containers are so much better for this.
Yeah. Yep. It always reminded me of Gen 2 when you were like, it's been 3 months. Let me go update my entire system and see what breaks. Because it's not if, it's what's going to break today.
That's why I didn't use Gen 2. I'm not that much of a sadist.
That's how I learned Linux, which I have to admit forces you to really appreciate anyone anywhere else. But it's also been about 15 years since I played.
It explains a lot about your personality.
It does.
That's how you learn Linux. Like, no wonder why you think technology can't save us.
I mean, I went from 8 years of AWS to jumping into Azure for a full-time job, but barely touching Azure before.
Hey, I went from, you know, I don't know, 10 years of AWS into Google. So
Yeah, but one's Microsoft. I feel like that's... Yeah.
It is worse.
Yeah. It is worse, yes. I mean, like at least you're running a .NET app. I mean, you could be running a Java app on Azure. That would be worse, I think.
Just no comments.
Yeah.
All right. Amazon API Gateway now supports dual stack IPv4 and IPv6 endpoints. Finally. This is across all endpoint types, custom domains, and management APIs in all commercial and AWS GovCloud US regions. You can configure REST, HTTP, and WebSocket APIs and custom domains to accept calls from IPv6 clients alongside the existing IPv4 support. You can also call the manager API via IPv6 or IPv4. Remember that AWS still charges you for the IPv4 address that you cannot remove. and so you still get to pay that penalty, but you now get IPv6 on top.
I mean, I'm glad these all exist, but it is really funny because I just keep waiting for this to be like necessary because I've been, you know, the doom and gloom has been preached to me for so long, but I still just don't see a whole lot of IPv6 in the wild.
It's pretty required in mobile. Like, that's really the big area you need it, because mobile networks have all gone IPv6. And so,
yeah, it makes sense.
And they have a lot of gateways that'll get you from IPv6 to IPv4. So, like, but like, if you want performant mobile app, you need to go IPv6. That's where I see a lot of it these days.
Hmm. That would explain why that's there. And API gateway, you definitely need it for
mobile apps.
A lot of mobile apps, yeah.
Yep. Exactly.
It's one of those things that surprised that it didn't have it.
I'm surprised it took this long, to be fair. Yeah. You know, this was a long time coming.
Like, that's where I am. Like, load balancers have had it for, I don't even know how long.
Well, it hasn't been that long for load balancers either. It's only been like maybe
a year, maybe 18 months.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No,
it really hasn't. Yeah.
No. They always had the IPv4 and IPv6 option, like to do the dual. I thought they just added the only IPv6 option.
No, they introduced dual stack with public IPv4 application load balancers in July of 2024. And that's without needing an IPv4. I'm sorry, maybe you might be right. When did the dual stack come out?
Dual stack's been out for a long time. I even think classic load balancers, which now that I say that word out loud makes me feel old, ELBs, had dual stack capability.
And I'm Googling now. When did AWS release IPv6 support for application load balancer? Maybe it was an ALB feature, but maybe it wasn't a classic feature.
Classic load balancer on here.
Around 2017, it says for ALB.
For classic load balancers, does support both.
All right.
Fine. You win this round.
I remembered something. Yay.
I did say that CLB didn't get it until much after ALB.
IPv6 only, though. I think it's the only
classic load balancer getting the IPv6. It came after ALB got IPv6. But yes, the IPv4-less ALB just came out in July. That's what I think Ryan and I were remembering.
Yeah.
You don't have to deploy IPv4 version. Okay. That's why you have us go here, the cloud host, to be your experts. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And still be wrong sometimes.
Yeah, it's still wrong all the time.
Often.
Amazon EKS community add-ons catalog is now available. EKS supports add-ons that streamline support operations capabilities for Kubernetes applications. These add-ons come from AWS partners and the open source community. But discovery of these tools across multiple different avenues has resulted in chaos and security and misconfiguration risks. To fix this, Amazon is releasing the Community Add-ons Catalog, which provides a way to streamline customer operations by integrating popular community add-ons through native AWS management, broadening the choice of add-ons that users can install to their clusters directly using EKS Console, AWS SDK, CLI, and CloudFormation. I assume Terraform supports it as well. Some of the critical capabilities you can find in the add-on catalog include essential capabilities such as Metric Server, Kube State Metrics, Prometheus Node Exporter, Cert Manager, and External DNS. And if you have an add-on that you would like to add to the catalog, you can create an issue on the EKS Roadmap GitHub requesting its inclusion. Those five examples, things all seem like things that should just be part of EKS. This is my personal opinion, but there are other add-ons that I definitely make sense to be in a catalog.
I thought Kube State Metrics was part of Kubernetes, so I'm like, really?
Apparently not.
Yeah. I knew Cert Manager.
I knew Cert Manager wasn't, but everyone just adds it. It's like day one, we're launching it.
Yeah.
And we've launched it. It's just part of everything.
Yeah. Metrics Server is one I was surprised. Kube State Metrics, which is around the deployments, nodes, and pods, that one I'm not surprised it's an add on. But the Metrics Server, which is basically CPU and memory usage of Kubernetes nodes and pods, that one felt like that should be part of it, right? Because that's how kubectl top works.
It goes to show you what we know. These things, I've just always taken it for granted, I think.
Yep. It's probably just part of the base image we're deploying, and you just didn't know it. But now it's going to be part of this catalog. So.
Yep.
Well, glad
now the security part of you now gets to say every day, hey, did you update to the latest version? There's vulnerability in there.
And Snick are now best friends.
Yeah.
Or Sneak, whatever it's called.
Sneak.
I think everyone has their own pronunciation, whichever one they like the best. I don't even know if they have an official answer to that question.
I thought we looked this up and they did. And
I think we did, but
it was wrong. So we just
ignored it. Amazon Bedrock custom model import integers is real time cost transparency. So when importing your customized foundational models on demand to Bedrock, you now get full transparency of the compute resources being used and calculate inference costs in real time. This launch provides you with the minimum compute resources, custom model units required to run the workload model prior to model invocation in the Bedrock console and through Bedrock APIs. As the model scales to handle more traffic, CloudWatch metrics provide real-time visibility into the inference cost by showing the total number of CMUs used. Okay.
The only common metric is money. What? No, I'm kidding. This is, someone got in trouble with their CFO. And we're like, well, how am I supposed to know? Yeah, so this is good. I'm sure it's a big problem. I haven't done a whole bunch of custom models, but I can see if you have your own custom model and you start serving requests And you can't really tell how much that's costing you. I can see that being a problem.
Mm-hmm. All right. In a recent episode, sometime in 2025, I did not look this up. I could not recall which one it was. Matt said to us that he thought Beanstalk was dead. And I have an announcement to say otherwise, because Beanstalk today now supports retrieving secrets and configurations from AWS Secrets Manager and AWS Systems Manager Parameter Store. This new integration provides developers with a native method for accessing data from these services in their applications, so you don't have to put your secrets into Beanstalk directly now. So, hey, that's a new feature, so it's not completely dead. You're welcome.
Crazy new feature for services that have been around a very long time.
That have predated both the Parameter Store and the Secrets Manager by multiple years. Yeah, it's a bit dated.
Yeah.
Clearly, that's one Pizza Box team that's doing mostly bug fixes, but they got this feature in. So, yeah, they're doing just fine.
Yeah. I mean, or there was a big enough customer. Like, our whole thing runs on Beanstalk. You must fix it.
It's more amazing that it just wasn't there. I'm still like, every time I read this now, so I'm like, but it should have been there years ago. I understand these services are really old, but still.
Yeah. You know, I did go to the, I was looking for, the blog articles for Beanstalk, and I found one that made me cringe. So it was published on August 7th of 2024. And the title, I'll just give you the title, Deploy to Elastic Beanstalk with Azure DevOps.
No,
I was like, why?
No.
Why would you do
Please
this?
Don't
this
do
is
that.
A terrible plan.
Mm-hmm. I'm upset just from no. No. Bad, Justin, bad.
Yeah. But it is pretty bleak when you look through the blog for Beanstalk things. This is the most recent thing I've seen in quite a while. So it's not dead, but I'm going to say that's, maybe you should move to Amplify at Beanstalk's current situation. All right. And our final announcement, Amazon makes it easier for developers and tech enthusiasts to explore Amazon Nova with its new website, https://nova.amazon.com. And I had to ask, can we now kill Party Rock? Because I hate the Party Rock thing.
You mean Bedrock?
No, Bedrock is behind the scenes. Party Rock was their hackathon project to make it easier to use Bedrock, if you recall.
Oh, I forgot
don't
about
recall
that.
Because I have a 5-second memory, but that's hilarious.
Yeah, so if you go to partyrock.aws, you can see how you could have tested these things before. And it definitely looks like a hackathon project in UI experience.
Oh, now I remember it.
It's
no, now, now,
yeah, it's best.
Now that I see it, it's jogging those horrible memories back.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm hoping we can kill that now because we have Nova, which is a much better website. But funny that they've realized that all the other major chat GPT type solutions have their own websites. So
I was just convinced they weren't going to do this ever, right? Like it'd been so long, it's kind of nuts that they're still out there. Like I feel like someone got in trouble.
Right. And the press release that I quoted here and has some great commentary. So Amazon has realized that while they've created numerous generative AI applications, including Alexa Plus, Amazon Q, and Rufus, as well as tools like Bedrock, using their cutting edge Amazon Nova engine, they are now rolling out nova.amazon.com, a new website for easy exploration of their foundational models. Like, cool. Like you just figured that one out? Okay. As well as they're introducing Amazon Nova Act, which will be their new AI model trained to perform actions with a web browser. So nice to catch up with ChatGPT and Claude. They're releasing a research preview of the Amazon Nova Act SDK, which will allow developers to experiment with an early version of the new model. And there was a quote here from Rohit Prasad, SVP of Amazon Artificial General Intelligence. Nova.amazon.com puts the power of Amazon's frontier intelligence into the hands of every developer and tech enthusiast, making it easier than ever to explore the capabilities of Amazon Nova. We've created this experience to inspire builders so that they can quickly test their ideas with Nova models and then implement them at scale in Amazon Bedrock. It's an exciting step forward for rapid exploration with AI, including bleeding edge capabilities such as the Nova Act SDK for building agents that take actions on the web. And we're excited to see what they build and hear their useful feedback.
Yay. Awkward silence at its best.
Yeah. I love when you guys like to stare at me like, that was terrible. Why are we doing this? Yeah.
We all read this before and decided that we still want to keep this in.
I mean, hey, it's a full press release. That's how excited Amazon is about Nova. So I do look forward to seeing what they do with Nova in the future because I think it's a cool idea. I tried to use it with Klein because it has one of the options is to connect to Bedrock to then connect to Nova. And Klein doesn't have full support for Bedrock properly, so I can't actually test it there. I tried, but it was sad. I couldn't quite do it.
I mean, I did a few requests while we were recording just now, like on that website.
Oh yeah, I just sent on the website too. I tried to create an image and I did a couple of searches and stuff, and it works just like ChatGPT and Gemini and all the other ones that I've used. So
should be just fine.
Yep. Works just fine. Check the box. Met the requirements of all other basic LLMs. Table stakes. All right, guys, it's time for GCP. And before we get to our rock solid predictions, because this show will hopefully drop on Monday right before Google Next starts. If you are there listening to this and our terrible predictions, and you were like, you want to come tell Ryan and I how bad our predictions were, we will be at two sessions for sure, guaranteed, because I'm talking at them. Well, Ryan might not be there, but I'll be there for sure. BRK2-024 and BRK1-028. These are so lovelyly named. Workload optimized data protection for mission critical enterprise apps and unlock value for your workloads, Microsoft, Oracle, OpenShift, and more. I will have a brief cameo in both these presentations. I will have stickers if you are there from the Cloud Pod. You want to support me and my talk. They're good sessions. I cannot talk about anything they're talking about in those slides in my Google Next predictions. So, but I do know there are some cool stuff they're talking about in those sessions as I've seen the decks. So looking forward to those two talks. I'm mostly looking for them to be over at this point because I'm already tired of talking about them, but I am looking forward to doing them and enjoying Google Next week.
And of course, I'll be there to, you know, be your entourage and treat you like the...
Mostly to heckle me. I know how.
Well, I mean, it depends how well it's going. Like,
what days are your...
So the one talk is on Wednesday and the second one is... No, sorry. One is on Thursday, one's on Friday. I try to get this right so I show up at the right place at the right time.
And, you know, people can find you if they're actually going to Google Next.
Yeah, exactly. Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. This whole having the conference Wednesday, Thursday, Friday is really messing up my whole worldview of conferences. Like, Tuesday through Thursday is the sweet spot for conferences. I don't know what they were thinking. Because, like, everyone's going to leave for after the party on Thursday night. No one's going to show up to the sessions on Friday. That's my feeling.
Oh, yeah. Every time. I mean, even AWS did that, I think, a little bit, where they had stuff
on Fridays. That's supposed to be basically repeat sessions for people who are like, I really wanted to go to this session and I missed it.
Didn't want to wait for the YouTube.
I just needed something to do for the 4 hours before my plane left. So, you know, that's what I call those sessions. And I just pretend every tech conference is Monday through Friday.
Yeah.
There are a lot of cloud cost management tools out there, but only Archera provides cloud commitment insurance. It sounds fancy, but it's really simple. Archera gives you the cost savings of a 1 or 3 year AWS savings plan with a commitment as short as 30 days. If you don't use all the cloud resources you've committed to, they will literally put the money back in your bank account to cover the difference. Other cost management tools may say they offer commitment insurance, but remember to ask, will you actually give me my money back? Archera will. Click the link in the show notes to check them out on the AWS Marketplace.
Well, we did roll the dice before the show recording, and Ryan rolled the highest number, followed by myself, and then Matt drew up last, which he's both happy about and terrified because he's worried we're going to steal his numbers. Mm. And so, as typical, what we do is for the Bain keynotes, both the primary keynote on Wednesday that TK will be doing and the developer keynote, we are looking for announcements. And those announcements, if they are mentioned on stage, you will get a point. If they're only on a press release that's not mentioned on stage, you will not get a point. And if they're mentioned in my session that not on main stage, you will not get a point. So you are going to try to guess what those are. Each person will get three predictions in draft order. And if we have a tie, we will have a tiebreaker, which will be the number of times the word AI or machine learning is said on stage, which is our favorite way to go. And so that will be our tiebreaker. We also accept AI and artificial intelligence, ML, or machine learning to make sure I'm quite clear on the rules here as a question.
What about LLM?
I don't know. You guys can make that decision. I would say no. Well, no, actually, I'd say yes. LLM is probably fair.
I'm not going to say this and change my random guess. I'm going to decide at the moment of the prediction. But
no, you bring this up when you lose. And so you're like, but did you count this? And
then. Yeah. I mean, then, yeah, so then we get LLM or large language model if they said either of those. But
I'm dyslexic, so ML, LLM, close enough, kind of matches in my head.
Yeah, there's a lot of things here. I mean, are you going to are they going to say foundational models? Or are they going to, okay. Just AI or ML. I'm calling it here. You can make an argument if it's a tie that you should get a point because they said LLM. Okay? You make that case. Next. after we get back from Google Next. So we will not be recording next week because we'll be busy. But
he got testy here about this.
The only guy realized how much homework would be for me and how much more work it would be to count that, and I don't want to do it.
And he knows he has to, you know, put us in our place.
100%.
All right, so that's the rules. That's how it works. That's the game. And Ryan, you are up first on our prediction.
All right. Because I know everything's going to be AI, and because all of my research was... and it was really difficult to find anything else, really, you know, in terms of like what people are thinking and what people are doing. It's cutting edge. So I landed on responsible AI. So I think, or hope, maybe, either way, that there is going to be either in the console or some sort of service where it allows you to sort of enable and visualize your responsible AI usage or creation.
Okay. I think I got that. So responsible AI and either the console, a service, or an SDK to enable and or visualize your responsible AI creation or usage. Mm-hmm. Okay. That feels very specific, but we'll see how it goes.
Oh, I'm going to make, if they say responsible AI once, I'm going to make the case.
Nice.
They say the word responsible, he's going to make the case.
Probably.
Yeah. So I am going to go with, they're going to be adding AI agent capabilities being added for DevOps, machine learning, science, et cetera, across the Google consoles. So if you want help configuring Kubernetes or launching things, they'll have a specific agent available to you right natively there in the console that'll do the work for you. So I'm expecting agents everywhere.
I thought they announced that already.
Not in the console.
So they all have
They've announced it for specific services like BigQuery. I know they
For BigQuery, yes. And for Looker, they did something, but I'm saying like Kubernetes, the things that we care about as cloud practitioners.
Mm-hmm. And they already have sort of that Gemini button in most services. I don't know. Yeah.
I mean, Gemini for help is one thing. I'm saying this is an agent that'll do it for you.
Right. Okay.
All right, Matt, you're up with the third pick of the draft, your first pick.
I'm going to say there's going to be a section talking about green AI and how, you know, they are focused on making it be more environmentally friendly and all those that good jazz.
Fool, I made that prediction last month. I lost.
So did I think. I think I made it for the AWS. My theory is if I just keep doing it, eventually I'll win.
That is Jonathan's tactic as well. Yeah. And it's worked out eventually.
Surprisingly so. Mm-hmm. Right. That puts us back to Ryan for your second pick.
Oh, I thought it was like Snake. Okay.
Snake. Sorry.
Fine. What I sort of capitalizing on what you said the other day, because I think I think there's going to be some sort of endpoint protection for security tools. And so this is sort of like my theory is kind of shot down by their Wiz acquisition, because I think that they'll just recapture that. But I'm still going to say it just because I don't have any other ideas, that they're going to have some sort of agentless vulnerability scanning or endpoint protection of some sort.
All right. So endpoint security tools like CrowdStrike or patch management and vulnerability. Do you want to really limit it to serverless?
Agentless is what it is.
Agentless. Do you really want to limit it to agentless?
He's very detailed.
Okay. No. Now that you're asking me these questions, I'm questioning everything. So
I'm going to not put that there to give you a broader opportunity to hit this. I'm just going to help you out a little bit. All right, I'm going to go a new next generation of TPU processors optimized for multimodal workloads.
Well, that's a gimme.
Hey,
yeah.
This is how I win this, because I take the easy ones.
Yeah, that was one of my four.
Nice. Optimized for multimodal. I did limit it, as I said, it has to be optimized for multimodal.
Mm, okay, I think that's fair.
Yep. Matt, that puts you on your second pick.
I mean, just because I'm getting tired of AI.
Aren't we all?
I'm going to say they're going to release 5 features during the keynote that are not AI specific.
So, and just to clarify, so they'll have AI potentially as a part of it, but it's not AI agents or AI LLM. It's a feature. AI might be in it, but you're saying it's a new feature that isn't about managing or dealing with AI.
Yeah. For lack of a better example, VNets, or, you know, something with like a new VNet capability, something outside of this world. So
but you're
going to
go with five of those. Like that feels ambitious.
I was going to go with two, but that felt like it was too, like I was going to do one and I was like.
Why don't you settle at three? I think three might be a
safe. Three. Okay.
Five feels too much.
Yeah. Five, you're never going to get that one. Yeah.
And then you're going to be arguing with us and be like, I had three. You guys should give this to me. And I'll be like, well, if you said three,
I said a number. I mean, I hold to that number.
Honestly, think you're only going to get one of these if you're lucky, but we'll see.
I thought one was like a little bit too easy and needed to be harder, but maybe I just go for the hard options, which,
I mean, you do take the hard options. That's, you need to go work for an Azure.
Yeah. Well, so, as previously
discussed, I don't make good life choices. I gather.
Well, it does sort of segue into my next prediction, which is that they won't be announcing any new services or products. It'll be limited to just, you know, enhancements in Vertex AI, you know, new agents. And, you know, I do think they will announce new generations of chips, but I don't think there'll be any service.
I don't say any new service. All right, we'll see. We will see. All right, my third and final pick. I also am tired of AI, but I feel like that's a fool's game not to go AI. But
I know
I have two choices. I could go with one more AI one, or I could go with a non-AI. I might go non-AI just to keep this.
Go big, Justin.
I'm gonna go back with one I've called out multiple times: a unification of Anthos and GKE Enterprise. Because I think it's ridiculous that they are still separate and unclear in their marketing message on that. This is my third attempt trying to get them to do this. So we'll see. We'll see if it works out.
Is it just the product documentation? Because like I thought they did announce Anthos was being rebranded officially, but it's still everywhere.
They still talk about Anthos. They still talk about GKE Enterprise. Like they're two different things. So
it doesn't make it very difficult to figure out what GK Enterprise is.
Either unification or major enhancement. How's that?
All right.
Matt, your third and final. Would you like what my other one would have been to give you an idea of what you might say here?
Yes, but I also have one that I was going to do, so now I'm curious.
I think you should be thinking verticalization and industry specialization in AI. That's my hint to you.
I was going to go with security in AI. With the acquisition of Wiz, I think that there's going to be some sort of AI Wiz security type announcement during the keynote.
I mean, so Ryan's already got you called out on endpoint security tools. So it has to be not an endpoint security tool.
Not endpoint
And it's
security.
Not going to be Wiz because the Wiz acquisition will not close.
So they won't have a chance.
It won't be close. Yeah. That's what I was thinking. I forgot that this was just the acquisition, not the close date. Some reason I had in my head it closed. That's how slow life is going right now.
I mean, like now, maybe another acquisition would be announced on stage. I could see that. Like I could see lots of different things that could happen in the security space.
I still think it's going to be something with security and AI, whether it's maybe more around like the actual communication of like, and the guardrails of the AI and like giving people more guardrails and more guardrail options.
Sounds great. Any honorable mentions you guys want to bring up? I'll put the industry verticalization, verticalization for AI LLM models, either fine tuning marketplace or special models for specific industry or use case. Okay. Any other honorable mentions?
Yeah. I think that they're going to announce a personal assistant for the Google Workspace productivity suite. But I wasn't sure if they actually covered that in this conference or not. So.
They do cover workspace stuff. Okay. It's sort of a weird question. Oh, by the way, we just did a Google Mail.
Yeah,
I was also wondering if like I didn't think phones or anything, but like some sort of like AI, more like Gemini integration into the
OS. They won't really cover Android stuff. That's typically done at I/O.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's where I wasn't sure like where the lines were.
They, I mean, they might mention something around Gemini and that'll get, you'll see it in Android as well, but it's typically not an Android specific announcement.
Mm. Okay.
That's like, that's the whole build versus Ignite build versus conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a Google I/O, which is their developer conference where they talk about Amazon or they talk about all of the phone stuff and the new version of Android, et cetera. And whatever lovely, delicious dessert it's named after, if they still do that. I don't even know because I don't have Android.
Yeah. But that's what I list to.
I don't think they formally do it, but I think it's still like one of those.
I think internally they probably still do the code names, but they just don't publicly announce it yet. All right.
I mean, everyone knows they get leaked.
Let's see. Did I have any other honorable mentions I wanted to bring up? AI suggested multi-cloud tools, which I didn't. I made that bet before and not won that one. So multi-cloud tooling, it's possible. I could see it.
I was stoked to find out it's a part of the security offerings.
Yeah.
So,
Yeah, I think that as best as my crystal ball is for Google, I think that's a pretty good bet.
Yeah.
I think. All right, so then the question, you know, Matt, you get to pick how many times I can say AI or ML on stage. You get first pick.
52.
52 times. This is both the keynote and the developer keynote. We exclude the partner keynote. I'm going to go 97.
Woo! Going big.
I was actually.
And Ryan, what do you think?
It's closest without going over, right? That's the rules.
Yeah, so you could go one if you wanted to, because price is right rules.
Yeah, because my number was going to be lower than 52, so I am going to go one.
All right, good call. Might be the winning play right there. All right, well, let's get into the things they announced that you guys did not predict, which is good. Google is really nibbling on the edges of backup and disaster recovery this month with another feature this week. which I think is maybe a sign that ransomware is still a big problem for people or a concern.
Mm-hmm.
Backup Vault was announced last year as a powerful storage feature available as part of Google Cloud Backup and DR services. The point is to secure backups against tampering and unauthorized deletion and integrate with Security Command Center for real-time alerts on high-risk actions. But to further support security needs, they're deepening the integration between Google Backup and DR and Security Command Center Enterprise. This includes new detections, including threats to the Backup Vault itself and end-to-end workflows to help customers protect their backup data more easily. Nice. That's good.
Yeah. I mean, I think not only is ransomware still a big issue, but also it's hit the compliance round. So there's like, it's a question that comes up all the time in any kind of security audit or attestation, or even if like a customer walkthrough. So it's definitely an issue that's in the front of people's minds and something that's really annoying to fix in reality. So this is great.
Specifically, like, offline backups that are immutable, because so many people have everything just in the cloud. They're like, yeah, we have DR in the other region and it's S3 applications the other region or GZRS or whatever the extra letters are on Azure, you know, for perpetual backup, but it's all online. So really the immutable piece is what I feel like is really the key here with a lot of this.
Oh yeah, definitely. And it's, you know, it's just such a operational challenge, right? With that immutable or, you know, the write once, read many sort of strategy. It's not as easy. It's not the easy button that we've been, you know, privy to previously. Then just dump it all on an S3 bucket. But now you actually have to manage it and make sure the access is there. And you can't fix it if you blow it up.
Another thing that people think are dead, but still kicking like a zombie, is the mainframe.
Yeah.
And Google has a mainframe announcement this week, which is always weird. Yeah. When a cloud provider has a mainframe announcement. Google and a company I've never heard of called MLogica have announced an expanded partnership focused on accelerating and de-risking mainframe application modernization, combining MLogical's LibreM automated code refactoring suite available at the marketplace with Google Cloud Dual Run for validations and de-risking, offering a validated modernization path to their joint customers. LibreStarM provides automated assessment, code analysis, dependency mapping, and code transformation capabilities, and supports multiple target languages and platforms, including a crucial foundation for refactoring your projects. Google Dual Run, which I did not know existed,
me either,
enables a simultaneous operation of mainframe and cloud applications in parallel, letting you compare and validate refactored applications before cutting over. This, along with powerful testing capabilities, enables a controlled phase transition, minimizing business disruptions, and substantially reducing the risk inherent in large-scale mainframe modernization projects.
I mean, that's pretty smart, because a lot of people refuse to get off of mainframes because of the perceived risk, right? And they don't want to, even if it's just calculated differently or more correctly, you know, they still don't want that computational difference to be in there. So providing the sort of side-by-side comparison of the results is pretty smart.
I mean, they could expand this beyond mainframe. There's a lot of business applications that, you know, people want to run parallel, and but building parallel pipelines is expensive and hard. Like, there's lots of use cases for this.
I wonder if we'll see a lot more of these announcements.
Oh. I was just saying the dual run feature, I think, is really cool, and because I've helped customers do these migrations before, and it's like, yeah, it's just a pain to do. And at one point, you're like, we're gonna hit the big button and cut over and make sure hopefully everything works. Otherwise, we're in deep trouble.
Yeah, I wonder if we're going to see a lot more of these announcements as, you know, like the code modernization and AI sort of takes hold of that, right? Because we know that some of the older languages, there's the brain drain has happened as people have retired and people don't know some of these things anymore. But AI can be trained on it pretty simply and use, you know, generate new ones, or maybe it'll even generate these modernization paths.
Well, Google has a Geek Out article for us, guys. Sweet. I always love these. They have another update on Colossus. Colossus is their expansion of their foundational distributed storage system. It used to be called GFS or Google File System. Basically, this handles all of the object storage and file storage that Google offers to their cloud customers and has an easy-to-use programming model that's used by all Google teams. Moreover, it does all this while serving the needs of products with incredible diverse requirements, be it scale, affordability, throughput, or latency. And they gave some examples. The example application, BigQuery scans, hundreds of kilobytes, tens of hundreds, expected performance, terabytes per second. Cloud storage standard, kilobytes, tens of megabytes, hundreds of milliseconds expected performance. Gmail messages, tens of milliseconds of performance. Hyperdisk reads, less than a millisecond of performance, and YouTube storage is in megabits and IO sizes, but seconds in expected performance. Basically, the Colossus metadata, GFS system is modeled to append only storage system that combines file system's familiar programming interface with scalability of object storage under the hood. The Colossus metadata service is made up of curators that deal with interactive control operations like file creation and deletion, and custodians, which maintain the durability and availability of data as well as disk space balancing. Colossus clients interact with the curators for metadata and then directly store data on D servers, which host either SSD or HDDs. Or hard disks, basically. It's also good to understand that Colossus is a zonal product. They build a single Colossus file system per cluster, an internal building block of a Google Cloud Zone. And most data centers have one cluster and thus one Colossus file system, regardless of how many workloads run inside the cluster. Many Colossus file systems have multiple exabytes of storage, including two different file systems that have an excess of 10 exabytes of storage each. And all I can say is someday there will be a massive Colossus-related outage for a lot of customers, potentially. I bet they have really good testing on this thing.
Yeah.
I'm just still remembering the S3 outage where the guy rebooted too many servers at once.
Yep. Demanding applications also need large amounts of IOPS and throughput. In fact, some of Google's largest file systems regularly exceed read throughputs of 50 terabytes a second and write throughputs of 25 terabytes per second. This is enough throughput to send more than 100 full-length 8K movies every second.
Wow.
Their single busiest cluster does over 600 million IOPS combined between read and write operations. And previously, when they talked about Colossus, they talked about how they place the hottest data on SSDs and balance the remaining data across all the devices in the cluster. This is more pertinent today, as over the years, the SSDs have gotten more affordable, but still pose a substantial cost premium over blended fleets of SSD and HDD drives. To make it easier for developers, they have an L4 distributed SSD caching layer with dynamic picks of data that is most suitable for SSD, so the developers don't even have to think about the tiering. Take that, Amazon. Overall, this is a great deep dive into a bunch of other nuance and details of L4 caching, et cetera, that we won't talk about here. But I love these type of articles because they just help you understand how your cloud is built.
Yeah. And it, you know, like this is how you build systems at scale, right? Because we don't use Colossus directly. We use services that are run on Colossus. And so like the teams, all those individual teams that are writing those services now have just a common framework, a common system, the enablements of, like you said, not having to really think about the tiering. It's just all built into the service and allows you to focus on, you know, your area of the service that matters the most, which is the customer experience. And I, you know, like I love to see companies sort of develop and then also tout their backend systems like this, because it's super awesome, especially with, you know, metrics at this scale.
Yeah, I mean, I love when you share with me secret NDA data from Yahoo days, scaling Yahoo Mail.
Yeah.
Like that's just fun. But I mean, those are old technologies now.
Yeah, I mean, it's not really NDA because there was, you know, a whole bunch of tech posts about it. But yeah, no, I mean, this is near and dear to my heart just because of that, you know, when we're trying to adopt a new Ceph service and trying to build basically an internal service like this. So this is fantastic.
Yeah. It is really cool, the scale they're dealing with here too. I mean, we talked about S3 during Pi Day, you know, and how much it's doing. Like, this is, you know, theirs is Google's version of what Amazon's built. Now, the thing that Amazon and Google can't differ on is that this is a big, massive service that lots of things use. And the fact that it's one cluster per zonal region is kind of shocking to me. But I mean, it makes sense when you think about the metadata and the direct write to the D server. So it makes some sense that it's not required to be, you know, more than one cluster, because you're separating the loadout in a fully distributed model. So it makes sense that that's not a big issue. It just, you know, when you say it that way, I don't know if I would have worded it that way. Like, yeah, you know, I think that's where Amazon kind of did a little better talking about micro. The S3 talked about, like, you know, all these little teeny tiny pieces of your files floating around, and
you know, the sharding of data around multiple places,
and so, like, you know, we have these, like, tons of clusters, and your data's, you know, you got all this durability because of this, and, like, so there's some things in how you market this is important. But, you know, basically Amazon has something similar, Google has something similar, I'm sure Azure pretends they have something with their Azure SAN, you know, that's similar to this, but
just NetApp's under the hood, it's fine.
Yeah, just NetApp all the way down at Azure. But yeah, this is cool. So this is definitely a geek out if you're into these kinds of things. Read more details. I just try to gloss over a bunch of the high level points, but definitely interesting.
It really just helps also build confidence, I feel like, in the clouds, like, you know, hyperscalers. While you don't think about it, you know, they are thinking about all these ridiculously complex problems. So, you know, you can go focus on what your business actually needs, which is nice. So when somebody goes and says, hey, are you sure we really should move here? Can Google handle are, you know, 1 terabyte of data, and you're like, here's an article where they handle billions of times more than that. Your 1 terabyte is nothing to them.
I just want dev teams to enable snapshots in their resources. I mean, I love hearing services like this, because this is what, you know, I'd rather be working on, sort of chasing teams down for compliance reasons.
I mean, you chose them to security.
I know.
I just got my risk register Jira tickets today. I was like,
yeah.
Now it's going to be Ryan complaining to me about these now. Great.
And maybe they'll be more real now because Ryan's doing them.
Oh, no. No.
I mean, Ryan has already gone and fought the good fight with our compliance team on many of them for me, which I really appreciate that he's done that work to show him, like, here's how it's mitigated and not the risk that you think it is. And he's done a really good job, like, de-risking a bunch of them, but they still exist. I still have to solve them. I just don't solve them tomorrow.
Yeah.
Right. They're now no longer critical. As you have 7 days, you have 30 days or
exactly
whatever.
Yeah. All right. And our last Google story, AI-assisted BigQuery data preparation now generally available. Surprised they didn't save this one for Google Next, actually. BigQuery data preparation is now generally available. It also now integrates with BigQuery pipelines, letting you connect data ingestion and transformative tasks so you can create end-to-end data pipelines with incremental processing, all in a unified environment. Features include comprehensive transformation capabilities, data standardization, automated schema mapping, AI suggested join keys for data enrichment, visual data pipelines, data quality enforcement with error tables, and streamlined deployment with GitHub integrations we talked about last week.
Automated schema mapping, man. It's probably my biggest life work improvement.
Could Athena get that, please?
Yeah, right.
Yes.
It's the bane of my existence.
Even just for the Azure, or even just for the AWS tables, the ones that AWS, can you just automatically know those?
Yeah. If AWS, you're generating this data that I'm now indexing Athena, please just provide me the schema out of a library.
In an accurate one, please.
Yeah.
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 Not, great. Oh, we've added these rows to ALB flow log or ALB access logs. Like, no. Just know what it is and move on with my life.
If they could just use their Amazon Q or this Nova thing to go update all the documentation that has the same examples, because, like, the schemas examples they have are wrong all over the place. You have to figure out which one's the most current to get the right version. Again, a library would be great, Amazon, if you're listening to us. All right, let's move on to Azure. If you're using Microsoft Fabric, surprise, you get a new bill. They're going to be charging you for those SQL backups. Previously, your Fabric capacity-based billing model included compute and data storage, and by default, the system provided a full weekly backup, differential backup every 12 hours, and a transaction log backup every 10 minutes. But after April 1st, 2025, backup storage will also be billed, and that exceeds the allocated DB size. So if your database is 100 gigabytes and your backups add up to more than that, you will now be paying for that, which is nice, I guess. But I'm a little perplexed because can I turn this off? Can I change the retention?
That's what I was wondering.
Yeah.
Because I mean, like, because, you know, a full backup alone probably compressed is probably going to be at least half the size of your database. So then you're doing differentials every 12 hours and you're doing a 10 minute transactional backup. If it's a busy database, you're going to be using a lot more storage than what the original database is on a weekly basis.
Probably what happened was they realized how much more storage this is actually using. And they were like, guys,
this is a revenue leak problem. We need to solve it.
Right.
Yeah. I'm kind of hoping that's since right. It was an April 1st announcement that this is going to be a joke tomorrow. You know, like, but I don't think so.
No, I think this was a few days ago.
This was posted on March 27th. Yeah.
Oh, but it's in the announcements after April 21st.
Oh, yeah. No, the billing starts after April 1st. Yes, that's true.
I realize that it's not going to be that, but it's just like, this is terror. I don't like these kinds of announcements because there's no value add to the customer, right?
You know, it's not. Well, what I find annoying. So this blog post was posted on March 27th, 2025.
You had 4 days.
And the timeline they said was there was no change until March 21st. And then from March 21st to April 1st, they were enabling the viewing so you could see what it was going to cost you, but non-billable. But then they didn't release this till the 27th, but it's effective in 4 days.
Yeah.
Like, what?
Yeah.
Like, that's ridiculous. Like, at least, you know, post this blog post, give yourself 2 weeks to figure it out. Like, or a month would be more ideal, but, you know.
It's whatever. Barely enough time. Just turn off all your backups.
Right. Which maybe you shouldn't turn it off.
I wonder if they went to all the customers that were any real amount behind the scenes.
I mean, I hope so. I hope that's the
case. And like, we're like, hey guys, just so you know, your bill's about to double. Good luck.
And this is how we learned Matt doesn't use Fabric. I'm surprised because to do any reporting on Azure, you have to have Fabric, it sounds like. So.
I will say Fabric is my weak point that I need to sit down and like really understand. And I just haven't spent the time on it because
we've had a crash course in it. This is an area that Ryan and I can actually be educational to you because we had to enable Fabric and to use Power BI for a product, and so we connected Power BI to GCP, and I can tell you all about it.
To be fair, I can mostly just tell you what not to do.
Yeah,
use Fabric. Just use Fabric. Start at that level.
Yeah,
yeah.
It just feels like it's their catch-all service for everything. And I know some stuff they're building in the future, which are pretty cool, but
that's why I call Fabric their version of Snowflake, because that's exactly what it feels like. It's a catch-all of a ton of analytical AI stuff that you may or may not need, but you'll stitch it together into something like Snowflake uses. Like,
yes. Idea. That's about what I understand about it.
Yeah. So this is where I wonder about security, Ryan. So they're announcing alert triage agents in Microsoft Purview powered by Security Copilot, which I'm like, cool. So Microsoft says, per their research, that organizations are facing up to 66 alerts per day when it comes to Purview DLP alerts, up from 52 in 2023, with teams only really able to review about 63% of the alerts. So when I math that means that the SOC team is only handling half of those 52 alerts, or 33 alerts this year. And given the sheer volume of data security alerts, it's no surprise that Microsoft says it's hard to keep up with these. Do you know how many alerts I get in ops per day? Like 66, I dream of that.
Yeah, I mean, I get you.
Well, apparently Microsoft's trying to help you, but not me.
Yeah.
Because they're giving you the help customers increase the efficiency of their data security programs. They're addressing key alerts and focus on the most critical data risks. Microsoft is thrilled to announce alert triage agents in Microsoft Purview Data Loss Prevention and Insider Risk Management, or ERM. These autonomous security copilot capabilities integrate directly into Microsoft Purview, offer an agent-managed alert queue that identifies DLP and IRM issues that pose the greatest risk to your business.
So I'd argue that the entirety of the cloud is to help you with your ops alerts.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know about buy that. But okay, sure.
Auto-scaling instead of the disk filling up full of logs.
You gotta, sure. You know. Okay.
You clearly don't use Azure, where things just hit alerts and it doesn't scale, or it can't scale, or it can never scale down if it scales up.
I mean, there is a harsh reality in these numbers, right? Because it's these, I think they're right, or optimistic, right, in the number of alerts that I actually looked at. And it's, you know, doing something with DLP is really tricky because you don't want to get all up in users' data, but you have to sort of figure out how to make sure that you are protected from data loss. And so each one of these investigations for these alerts is a little, you know, it's very
Time consuming.
Time consuming and very manually done, you know, with talking to people and making sure. And yeah.
So have you looked at Security Copilot?
I mean, they just announced it a couple weeks
no,
ago.
No, Security Copilot's been out for a little while.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. They just announced some enhancements to it. That's what
So I'm just sitting here reading this going, Purview has multiple levels. Security Copilot, when I looked at by itself, was base. I think it was several grand a month at best on the cheap end.
Yeah, so I mean, security tools aren't cheap.
There's, just felt very, you know, very expensive.
And there's a billion of them, and you need all of them to make up a narrative, because security narratives are less about the secure environment that you're creating and more about the narrative of the secure environment that you're creating. Like, you have to do a sales job every single time. So it's tricky. And, you know, one of the options that people use is to use tools that everyone knows.
Yeah. Oh, I'm very familiar with it.
All right. I have Oracle announcements for you this week.
A bunch of them.
A bunch. I know. Three. Yeah. Three lovely announcements.
Beat Azure.
Yeah.
I know. It's a weird, weird week. OCI, or Oracle Cloud, is making available the latest and greatest NVIDIA GB300 NVL72 and NVIDIA HGX B300 NVL16 with Blackwell Ultra GPUs, providing early access to the AI acceleration capabilities of these new models. You get the GB300, the B300 in bare metal, or you can use superclusters up to 131,000 NVIDIA GB300 Grace Blackwell Ultra Superchips as part of a rack-scale NVIDIA GB300 NVL72 solution. Which made me curious, how much does 131,000 NVIDIA GB300 Grace Blackwell Ultra Superchips cost? And I can't answer that question for you, as it was not an option in the pricing calculator. However, I was able to choose a GPU-optimized instance, which I picked the one option, which was the BM GPU GB200-4 with four GPUs and 750 gigs of memory running autonomous Linux for the low, low price of $857,088 in monthly on-demand costs. I have no idea. I think it's so four GPUs. So, I mean, if I were to do the math of four GPUs into the GB300, that must be very, very expensive to get a super cluster of that scale and size. But yeah, that one, I was like, wow, that is more than I owe on my house.
Right?
Yeah.
By a lot.
Never mind, like, making services with two pizza teams. Like, they're just burning money for two pizza teams.
Right? Like, I'm talking about CFOs having a bad day. You get that bill.
Right?
I could not figure out how to toggle. The Oracle calculator is terrible. I don't know if you've looked at it ever, but there's no easy way to choose between like on demand versus committed, you know, resources easily that I can see in this particular instance type. So I only have the on demand cost, but I assume you get some pretty hefty discounts. I hope at least half of that for $400,000 a year. But anyways, I hope you get multiple engineering resources out of those GPUs to justify the cost.
I want to be somewhere where I can turn to my CFO and say,
Do you for want this to be project, somewhere like that?
I want to. I just want to launch it once. I just think it'll be fun.
For it once, I want to pay for 1 second of it, please.
Yeah, like that's it. I just want to do the Terraform Apply, watch it launch, look at the console, and go, huh, there goes all that money.
I want to run Windows on it so I can open it up and see Task Manager and see all the CPUs just scaling off the screen.
I just want to make it the default option on a thing that I deploy. So if you don't actually read the documentation, it spits up one of these guys.
Yeah. I was pleased to see that if I chose something other than autonomous Linux, the price didn't change. So if I chose Ubuntu or OpenSUSE, it was the same price. So apparently the licensing of the Linux is included in this.
I wonder what the licensing for Windows of that would be.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, it doesn't have that many actual CPUs. That's the saddest part of it. So you're paying for the just GPUs.
Oh, that's true.
So for instances that are more our cost model, the new, more reasonably priced E6 standard bare metal and flex virtual machine instances are now available, powered by the 5th-gen AMD EPYC processors. OCI says they're among the first cloud providers to offer them. I checked this up. Google was the first. Oracle was the second. So
AWS announcement next week?
No AWS or Azure yet on this one. I had to check. These are the Turin-based AMD chips. They're not out yet for either of those two cloud providers. Oracle is promising a performance of 2 times that of the E5 at the same price, which is not a bad deal. This has a 2.7 gigahertz base frequency with a max boost up to 4.1 gigahertz based on the Zen 5 NVIDIA, the AMD architecture. You can configure the virtual ones for 1 to 126 OCPUs and up to 3 terabytes of bare metal memory or 1454 gigabytes of virtual machine memory. There are some also limitations in disk throughput and network bandwidth based on if it's bare metal or not. I didn't run the pricing on this one, by the way, but it's much cheaper than the one above.
It's probably still very expensive.
I'd hope so.
I mean, I doubt it. It's AMD EPYC. It's going to be at least 10% cheaper than an Intel.
Yeah, that's probably, that is true. It's just a lot of memory. But
yeah, I mean, the memory will cost you. I'm sure if you do bare metal, like that'll cost you a bit of money. But again, you're probably not talking six digits, maybe five digits.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah. I'd still get in trouble for running anything on this.
Well, I mean, you'd be fine if you did the virtuals and did small. But yeah, if you're trying to run the full box, you'd probably get in some trouble.
It's interesting that Oracle is the second provider that added it. And my next question is, how many regions is it actually launched in?
It's in a surprising number of regions.
For day one? Oh,
funny
interesting.
You should ask that. It's in the article. Oh. It is available in U.S. East Ashburn, U.S. West Phoenix, U.S. Midwest Chicago, Germany Central Frankfurt, and U.K. South London.
Okay, so five.
Hey, it's better than one.
Yeah, but like, how many regions does Oracle have? I feel like they must be up to like 90 trucks around the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but they're small trucks, so they can't put these in everyone.
Yeah, you can't get a lot of them. Let's see, bare metal servers. Let's see if I can find the cost of this for you guys. Real time, so, best podcast content ever. When you do these real,
there are a lot of dots on the Oracle public regions map.
There are a lot of dots. That is correct. I don't even know if this is the right box. Standard, this is an E5, right? EPYC 9J, E5 based standard compute processor, AMD EPYC 9J14 based 2.4. Nope, this is the right box.
E6 is this is compared to the E5.
Oh, that's right. E6 is the new one. Okay, yeah, here it is. $10,285 for a bare metal running autonomous Linux. So that's actually not that bad. It does jump up to $27,000 if you go for Windows.
Wow.
Thank you, Windows.
Yeah, so not bad. I only added 100 gigs of disk space because who needs more than that? But
you're using
$4.25 of data in there. Windows will cost you a bunch of money. Yeah.
Windows, by default, you have to have more than 100 gigs. The OS is that much.
I guess I don't. So a capacity reservation didn't change the price, which is sort of weird. I see. You tell it how many. Okay, I don't. Oracle pricing, weird. Okay. Real-time podcast follow-up over.
Yeah.
All right, move on to the last Oracle story. Oracle is apparently under fire for potential security breaches. The first one is related to Oracle Health, which is their acquisition of Cerner. The breach impacts patient data, and apparently they're blaming it on an old legacy server not yet migrated to Oracle Cloud. Way to pass the buck. Mm-hmm. And then the other breach may be on Oracle Cloud, and the Oracle is being a little cagey about this one. A hacker going by Rose87168 posted on Cybercrime Forum offering the data of 6 million Oracle Cloud customers, including authenticated data and encrypted passwords. Several Oracle customers have confirmed that the data appears genuine, but Oracle has stated that there has been no breach and published credentials are not from the Oracle Cloud. So where are they from, Oracle? There's a cybersecurity expert, Kevin Beaumont, writes, this is a serious cybersecurity incident which impacts customers and a platform managed by Oracle. Oracle are attempting to wordsmith statements around Oracle Cloud and use very specific words to avoid responsibility, and this is not okay. And my point on that is Oracle Cloud can't be unbreakable if it was hacked.
Yeah,
they didn't break it. It's still running.
True.
Yeah, it's just hemorrhaging your user data. No problem.
Yeah, no problem.
Yeah, no issue. All right, gentlemen, we have made it through another fantastic week here at the Cloud Pod. We are ready for Google Next. I'll see you next week, Ryan, in Vegas. I will not see you, Matt, but we'll think about you remotely. Not really, but maybe we'll think about you.
We might
just send me pictures.
We might drunk dial you.
Yeah, we might. That might happen. Because we have some of your other friends that you know that will be there with us, so we can definitely include you in the drunk dialing.
You should. I'm looking forward to it. If not, I'll just randomly call you guys. Yeah.
So you get a week off. Ryan and I are busy canning out stickers, hopefully. But you have a week off, so we'll see. We will record the next episode, not during Google next week, because we'll be busy. But the following week will be our recap show. It'll be a Google wall-to-wall show, we assume, unless they announce nothing, and then we'll replan that show.
But I will have won.
And Ryan will have won. We will definitely talk to you guys here in 2 weeks when we're back from our little break as we go to Google Next. So we'll see you on the next show. Have a good time in the cloud anytime.
Bye, everybody.
And that's all for this week in cloud. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Archera. Be sure to click the link in our show notes to learn more about their services. While you're at it, head over to our website at thecloudpod.net, where you can subscribe to our newsletter, join our Slack community, send us your feedback, and ask any questions you might have. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you on the next episode.